Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to this Tuesdays Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Thank you, as always, to the folks who are listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. As a heads up, we're going to be starting our next book club up. I'm going to try and do it this weekend, and then every 2 weeks in a sort of schedule that I will lay out as we go. I'm going to be doing tackling the first 7 chapters of David Thompson's A Sudden Flicker of Light. I'd mentioned this. You can pick it up at Amazon, wherever. It's a pretty kind of fascinating revisionist history. I talked to him on one of my other podcasts. There's some dark stuff we're going to get into here. Maybe it turns out movies are bad. I don't know. We might have to just end the show after I finish this course up. But we're not going to be doing a chapter by chapter breakdown because I don't have the bandwidth for that sort of thing or the granular. I don't think the granular analysis of that sort is really warranted here. But we're going to be doing, again, the first 7 chapters here, which tackles a big question, kind of a fundamental question about film, which is that is the art form fundamentally amoral? Since the movie business itself is fundamentally amoral, not immoral, mind you, amoral. We'll discuss. And as a reminder, if you want to take part in this discussion, you'll need to be a paying member so you can comment and do the chat, et cetera, all that's locked off unless you are a paying member. So go sign up. And now on to controversies and non-troversies, where we find that Warner Brothers is using copyright law to silence fan sites discussing potential spoilers for the new HBO Max show Lanterns. Note, this is what I just described to you is a complete and accurate description of what happened, as bizarre as that sounds. The sites in question did not post the episode ahead of time. They did not have unauthorized access to a script, as far as anybody knows. They did not even have reporting from inside sources telling them what was going to happen. Rather, Cosmic Book News and some other sites put together conjecture about what was going to happen in the series premiere of Lanterns, which, spoiler, closes with the shocking death of a character, based on casting and the period in which the show was set, as well as some promotional image. Basically, it was detective work. Warner Brothers responded by delivering copyright strikes to Cosmic Book News and these other outlets, and that had the intended effect of A, taking down the spoilers, while also B, serving as a warning to other websites that such discussions will result in significant penalties. And the penalties here are pretty significant. Matt McGloin, who runs Cosmic Book News, he was locked out of his social media accounts for the site during San Diego Comic-Con, which is one of their biggest traffic periods of the year. So there was like a real financial penalty here for them. Eric Gardner, writing in Puck, broke down the legal framework here. And I could get very in the weeds. I'm not going to. It's at least modestly tricky in terms of what is allowed and what is not allowed. There's case law that allows for extremely detailed descriptions of plots that are monetized to be removed on a copyright basis, right? Obviously, if somebody posts a full episode or even like clips from important points in those episodes, there's a potential copyright issue. If someone has access to a script or a source in the production and publishes a detailed breakdown of what happens before the film or the show is released, there is potentially a case to be made involving trade secrets and such. Basically, there's a monetary harm, you know, if people are convinced not to watch because they already know what's going to happen. Like there are arguments to be made here, but none of that is what happened here. It was pure speculation put together by a critic/reporter/whatever you want to call him, who was reading tea leaves. And look, I am the copyright hawk on this show, right? I think we need to give the FBI access to drones to find the hubs of the piracy and take them out. Just take them all out. But this strikes me as completely insane, like completely insane, legally speaking, but also just be a real kind of reimagining of the relationship between studios and fan sites, et cetera, that they've had kind of this symbiosis since the Ain't It Cool News days, right, Peter? I mean, like, this is a real big change in how the studios are interacting with these sites to try and gin up business and attention for their programs.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring up Ain't It Cool News. I mean, I assume you were a regular reader back in the 90s and the early aughts when it was a big force.
Alyssa,
I don't know if you were.
I would not describe. Yeah, so. I actually would not describe myself. I didn't really like Ain't It Cool News. I always thought those guys kind of sucked. But it was a big thing.
Yeah, I read it very, very religiously. I mean, it was sort of one of the first websites that I just checked every single day, starting probably around 98, 99, sometime around then, and really kind of informed a lot of my knowledge and sense of film fandom online. It wasn't exactly sort of what I thought of myself, but it was like, oh, these are other people who like cinema, and right, and this is how other people relate to cinema. And so it sort of really kind of set the tone for me in a lot of ways, even though, again, that's not to say that I agreed with it necessarily and certainly don't kind of identify with that worldview at this point. But a big part of what they did, if you remember, their strategy for getting attention was they reported on test screenings and they would produce quite detailed reports about what was in a movie based on a test screening 3, 4, 6 months in advance. There would be opinions about this, right, as well, right? So it wasn't just, let me tell you what's in it, right? And that, in some ways, that makes it more kind of a copyright, right? It makes it more obviously fair use because it's not just a description. It's then comment and criticism, right? Even though I, you know, sort of think that all of these things should be fair use. And at first, the studios were really mad about it. They were really upset. Like, what can we do to stop these people from getting into our test screenings? And then they realized that there was a better way to approach the Ain't It Cool News and the sort of, you know, the Dark Horizons and all the rest of these sites around that time. And it was, let's co-opt them. Let's invite them. Let's make them feel special. And because these guys were a certain type of film fan, a certain type of just fan, kind of did some criticism. They had opinions, you know, but it wasn't traditional sort of newspaper magazine criticism. It wasn't what Pauline Kael or even Roger Ebert did, which was, you know, this sort of sense of I am independent and I am exercising independent judgment, even if they sometimes thought of themselves that way. They realized you could basically buy these guys off and you could do it pretty cheap. You know, you give them a ticket to the junket, you put them in a room with a movie star for 15 minutes and you show them the movie 2 weeks early. And it worked pretty well. And this was a good strategy for the studios. It also, I think, helped degrade some of the sort of public sentiment around critics, because we all get this to some degree or another. I think, Sonny, probably you more than me and Alyssa, but like, you get people online, typically kind of Twitter rando types, who are still like, yeah, you only think that because the studio bought you off, right? Paid you for this, in some sense, bribed you, right? And yes, it is true that critics get to see movies in most cases a few days early. Really, it's often only 2 or 3. Every now and then, it's 2 weeks early, but like most of the time, it's 2 or 3 days early and you don't pay for the ticket. That's true. But aside from that, it's not a lot of benefits. And I honestly, in many cases, I now just pay to see the movie because it's more convenient, like the timing is more convenient to see it on a Thursday. But in any case, this sort of created this I think it worked to the studio's advantage in other ways by sort of degrading sort of the independence or the perception of independence from critics. But now it seems like they're trying to go in sort of reverse this and go in the other direction. And they're trying to use copyright law to do it. And I just think like they should not be able to do this. And this is at I don't want to say that this specific thing, this exact case that we're discussing here, is something that I had imagined in my sort of skepticism of copyright as it exists, you know, over the past 10 years. At the same time, what we see with copyright is that it sort of it provides tools for studios, for IP owners to aggressively stop people from saying things and stop people from trading, basically from moving speech around. From taking expressions that they want to sort of transfer from themselves to other people somehow or another. And that's not to say that I don't think copyright should exist. I am not like a total, you know, sort of like no copyright ever. But I'm always a little bit like, is this too strong? Is this like, should we weaken this? Like, should we, like, I am more of a kind of, like, I'm a soft dove on copyright rather than the hawk that you are, Sonny. And one reason why is I don't want there to be laws that give any quarter to what amounts to big corporations using the courts to suppress true speech.
I think it's worth noting here that they're not really using the courts, though. Like Eric Gardner in his Puck piece made a very explicit
that's fair
point.
Enough, but
Warner Brothers is not going to court on this, right? They're using the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, to essentially force the larger companies like Facebook or Twitter or whatever to use their safe harbor provisions to take these down. And, you know, look.
But that's a threat to go to court, even if it's not an actual court case. And the thing is that, yes, they might lose if they went to court. The big corporations, right? Like, but it doesn't matter at that point because the stuff has been taken down during the crucial period before the release. And the time tax, the burden ends up falling on small creators for, like, do you really want to go to court? Even if you're going to win this one, can you afford to spend a year in court fighting Warner Brothers or whoever?
Right. Well, no, yes, again, this is the basic problem. Alyssa, it does seem set aside the kind of silly nature of this. And let's be honest, we're talking about the series premiere of Lanterns, the Green Lantern show in which Coach Taylor uses a literal lantern to charge a power ring that allows him to create force fields that are green. This is what we're talking about. But the
that's serious stuff.
But there's a real issue here, and this is something we've seen. This is something we've seen in the political realm a little bit, where copyright strikes are used to get people to take down clips of news appearances, or somebody will play a Taylor Swift song very loud in a video to make a YouTube video unpublishable, right? Like these are the things that are happening that are, I think, a little bit more serious to stifle speech. Lord knows we have a very functional system of government that is able to do many things all at the same time. So this should be priority number one, but there has to be some sort of amendment to this law, to whatever, to the legal process to stop efforts like this from stifling speech.
There are two things that I find really troubling about this. The first is that this is part of a much larger campaign by the entertainment industry and individual stars to control the media coverage of their outputs, to box out the actual journalism and commentary on their new releases. You see this in the rise of network-created podcasts that are meant to corner the discussion of a show or movie. You know, before every HBO show now, before Apple TV shows, you get an announcement that the official podcast devoted to discussion of the show will be dropping every Thursday, every Tuesday, whatever. There is this attempt to end run sort of independent conversations about shows. You see this in magazine profiles too. The sort of notable kickoff example of this was Beyonce agreeing to be photographed for the cover of Vogue on the condition that she got to pick the photographer. And that the piece inside would not be an interview, it would not be a profile written by a member of Vogue staff or a freelancer, it would be something that she wrote herself. And there have always been, you know, Actors on Actors series, Interview Magazine, etc. There's always been some practice of famous people in conversation telling their own stories. But there really has been an attempt by individual stars and by corporate entities to attempt to box out people who are doing individual reporting, who are doing independent commentary on their shows. And I think that is both disappointing and a mistake. Because the truth is, you want there to, from a marketing perspective, you want there to be an organic, engaged community around your show, talking about it and arguing about it. That community can turn on your product for sure, but if that community doesn't grow up organically, it means on some level, your product has not taken hold. And so I don't think that these, you know, these in-house produced podcasts, discussion fora, et cetera, are particularly successful. You don't see them shooting up the podcast charts or anything else, but they are it's a sense of sort of free marketing to attempt to pull people out of sort of their own free-ranging conversations. And I think that sucks just from a confidence in the work, from a, you know, the health of the cultural discussion ecosystem. I find that closedness to be a huge bummer, right? It is, and look, there are always people who don't like the profiles that are written about them, right? Like Lynn Hirschberg in the 2000s, 2010s wrote a series of celebrity profiles for the New York Times that were really attacked by their subjects. The singer MIA was particularly offended by the way that she was portrayed. So we all see how that played out long-term over time. But I think there is, either you are important enough to be covered and discussed seriously and your work is good enough to create an independent groundswell, or it's not, right? Or you're this fundamentally, you're something other than art. You're something other than an important public figure. And so that is the first ground on which I hate this. The second is that, taken to its logical extreme, it suggests that, to a certain extent, it suggests that reporting and commentary ought to be illegal, right? I mean, if you can't speculate about something that's going to happen in a TV show on the basis of the tea leaves that you're reading, are you allowed to speculate on the president's economic plan? Are you allowed to speculate on the moves a corporation might be making? There has been a real attempt to sort of crack down on short sellers in the stock market, for example, who, you know, by just the short selling has in some ways a lot in common with investigative reporting, and that people take these positions, release research on the companies that they are targeting, and, you know, are supposed to be intervening in the market as a kind of public service. And there are almost no pure short sellers left anymore because there have been a variety of attacks on their ability to do what they do, corporate, legal, otherwise. And so, you know, as just thinking about sort of the principle of journalism, you know, the journey from sort of in it cool news to the integrity of the financial system is a long one, but I think it is part of a broader sense that people outside of a business or an artistic project, that their right to comment on that is suspect in some way. That it represents a kind of fraud, a kind of manipulation, a violation of intellectual property. I just think we see this in a lot of areas in public life. And it's really terrible, not just for TV shows, not just for movies, but for democracy.
So that's interesting that you would go that direction. I think you're mostly right there. I mean, I mostly agree with you. I would say, I don't think that this particular toolkit is going to be particularly valuable in enforcing the ability to talk about, say, or to speculate about, for example, what's going to be in a budget or, you know, in the next inflation report, a government report, just because those government reports are not intellectual property that can be owned, right? There's no kind of, copyright, trademark, anything around them. So you can't possibly, No, just really quick, but like the government doesn't need to do it that way because the government has the FCC. And we see this all the time, right? They don't go after people by saying, oh, you're breaking trade, right? This is a trademark violation or an intellectual property violation. We are now seeing quite consistently, especially under the Trump administration, the FCC being used as a tool for suppressing disfavored political reporting and speech. And so you just go directly there in a way that I find in some ways even more worrying than this.
Yeah. And I would say don't think of copyright as a toolbox. Think of it as a tool in the larger toolbox, right? I mean, you can use copyright, you can use the FTC, you can crack down on whistleblowers, you can sort of prosecute leaking, you can go after people for documents handling, you can allege that people's speech is somehow fraudulent or that it represents a coordinated attack on a business's interests. You can, you know, try to argue that it's market manipulation. But either way, I think you see this in this sense that, you know, people should not be able to poke around and talk about what they find. And again, I don't think it is, you know, again, I don't think this tool is going to work in every one of these situations, but there are a lot of tools in the box and people are getting very comfortable using them. I mean, you know, frivolous litigation of all sorts, as we know, can be really devastating to organizations, especially small ones. And so it's an ugly moment. And I wish Warner Brothers would stay out of it.
Well, and again, this is there is an element here that is the enforcement mechanism is governmental in the sense that, like, if you don't, you know, take down a copyright request in a timely fashion, you could theoretically be sued for multiple billions of, you know, the way the DMCA works is I think pretty effective, actually. I think they do a good job. And you need that. You need that, for instance, if somebody posts the full version of The Odyssey on Twitter, which is a thing that happened. Right. You need a mechanism to take that down in a timely fashion. And you need there to be a punishment for their not taking it down in a timely fashion. I think everybody would agree that that's basically fine. Even Peter, even our dove friend, Peter. But the problem here, again, is that you have functionally Facebook saying to Warner Brothers, OK, Cosmic News can't write about this. You're right. We're going to take it down. And it's all circumvented before you even get to the courts. I hope the Cosmic News guys sue Warner Brothers, actually. I would love to see the jurisprudence here. I would love there to be a case where somebody can actually say, hey, you can't sue us for using clips from a trailer because that is marketing material. Using that and commenting upon it is fair use. It's very obviously fair use. And you're, you know, This is all nonsense. But nobody actually wants to do that because it would be expensive, and the payoff would be pretty low. We need a crank libertarian billionaire who just wants to fund these suits against corporations taking speech down. You're my guy on this. You think about it.
I'll talk to my people. I mean, in fact, there are nonprofit law firms that. Take cases designed to sort of prove, like, test cases, right? Like, designed to prove a principle. They're not out to win, to make money. In many cases, those lawyers are making considerably less money than they would if they were in the private sector. They are often donor funded, sometimes by individuals, sometimes by foundations, a combination, a mix, right? And those organizations can do great work. And I mean, I don't know if any of them are going to want to take this very specific case, but it's the sort of thing that might pick the interest of some of these free speech organizations, especially some of the ones that sort of are a little more copyright skeptical and a little more focused on sort of being able to talk online. Because in fact, the way that the DMCA works and the way that copyright works today, there are low level chilling effects on online speech because of the ramifications of the DMCA, you know, nearly 30 years later. And in fact, the DMCA, this is funny because I was at, like, the other website that I started reading in 98 or 99, besides Ain't It Cool News, obsessively, was Slashdot. And those guys hated the DMCA. And I just remember kind of reading, like, oh yeah, they're kind of right about this. Like, this is a law that basically says you can't do what you want. You can't say what you want. You can't transfer information in the way that you want online. That could prove to be a problem. And I think,
yeah, no, it's
30 years later.
I mean, it's not, the DMCA is for the most part pretty much fine. The people shouldn't be allowed to just steal shit and send it all over the internet. And stopping that is good, actually. But There are, of course, limits. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that studios are using copyright law to try and squelch spoiler discussion? Peter.
It's absolutely a controversy, and I think Alyssa is totally right that in all spheres of public life, we have shifted from a, let's just sort of keep them in our, this is not that this is not going on, but like this mode of like, let's just pay them off to be nice to us, to a mode of big organizations, whether it's the government or whether it's big corporations, and trying to use the law to stop smaller independent thinkers and writers and speakers from saying stuff that they don't like.
Alyssa.
It's a controversy.
You know what? You know what? I just learned that. I took my headphones out when Sonny said it earlier. I knew there was a big spoiler, and I was really trying to avoid it. Now I'm on HBO's side.
I will say it's controversy. I might have to mute that last bit from Alyssa to avoid spoiling. You know, Alyssa, not everybody wants to live a spoiler-filled existence like you. You're foisting your beliefs on the rest of us. That's no
good. The episode's been out for a week, Serum, and the statute of limitations is up.
The statute of limitations on writing about it is up, but you're talking to me on our podcast. I should have asked. Like, I want to watch the show. I want to binge watch the show kind of when all the episodes are out, and there's only like one or two that's been posted.
It's a great pilot. So.
Well, you shouldn't watch it that way either. You should also watch it week by week as God intended. God and Warner Brothers. All right.
Anyway.
Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com where we're going to be talking. We're going to be talking about memoirs. We're going to get a little personal, talk about our, memoirs that we've read that have changed our lives and that sort of thing. Because speaking of life-changing memoirs, we're going to move on to the main event.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Law 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Tony, the new biopic about Anthony Bourdain from Matt Johnson, the director of Blackberry and Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, set during Bourdain's Vassar years and leading up to his entry into the Culinary Institute of America. One might think of this movie as Bourdain Begins, the shadowy reinvention of a child of privilege into something greater, something society changing. On the one hand, this is a very straightforward biopic, right? It hits all the major beats a biopic is meant to hit, right? You have the callow youth who's convinced of his own talent, yet naive in the ways of the world. This, of course, is the titular Tony. He's played by the holdovers Dominic Sessa. He has a sort of aggressive snideness that all such overintelligent young men have. And when we first see him, he's trying to BS his way through a fellowship interview with some Vassar professors in the hopes of getting a bunch of cash to spend the summer writing a novel. That sounds like the worst thing anybody has ever conceived of. But they see through him. They see through him just as the girl he's hitting on, Nancy, who's played by Emilia Jones, sees through him. Just as his mother, interestingly, Gladys, sees through him, which like is where the root of all his resentment comes from. The fact that his mother sees through who he is drives him crazy. When he loses out on the fellowship, he decides to trek up to Provincetown chasing Nancy, who he's convinced he has a shot with. When he sees her making out with a guy, he spirals. He gets real drunk in a restaurant and he starts grabbing a waitress and telling her he's a writer as if that's going to impress her. And then he gets tossed out by the chef, who's played by Antonio Banderas, who just goes by chef in the credits. And a roughneck line cook slash oyster shucker named Sal, who's played by Leo Woodall. Sal knocks Tony out and steals his wallet, leaving him with no way to get home. When Chef takes pity on him and lets Tony sleep on a hammock on his patio, he asks if he can stay, and Chef puts him to work as a dishwasher. And then Bourdain sets out on his road to redemption. Yes, he takes a detour or two as he learns about the joys of mid-afternoon cocaine bumps to get through the kitchen service and that sort of thing. But the real point of this film is the importance of good, honest work for the soul. And this is like I say the word soul intentionally, because this is a like weirdly religious movie in the sense that Bourdain was a very avowed atheist, right? The chef wants to work on, he says, I will work on you later to Tony. And he does, in fact, work on him. He takes him to church. He refers to bad boy Leo as the sin eater of their little crew. He baptizes Tony every morning with a little splash of water to wake him up. Meanwhile, Bourdain learns the importance of honesty. Just honesty. That's all. Just be true. Just be being true. It is not until he is honest with everyone, including himself, that he can be redeemed. And dear, like nearly the closing line of the film, it may have actually been the closing line. I wasn't sure. I can't remember now off the top of my head if anything came after. Is Eric Repair, who is Bourdain's real life friend, who is interviewing Tony Bourdain at this to join the Culinary Institute of America. He says, at least he's honest, which is like the closing. It's like the encapsulation of the whole thing. At least he's honest. It's like putting the theme of the film in bright neon letters over the top of it, which I always appreciate because I'm an idiot. Anyway, this is a pretty straightforward, clear-cut biopic. Like I said, the promise of early brilliance, a fall, a rebirth, a drug problem that almost derails things, a clash, and then finally, of course, redemption and success. You could track it almost beat by beat with the biopic parody Walk Hard if you wanted to. And it helps that Sessa plays smarmy. He plays smarmy very well. This is like he was born, between this and The Holdovers, Sessa's really born to play like the smarmy kid. Leo Woodall is also very, I think he is having kind of a breakout year very quietly. He was in Tuner, which came out earlier this year. Nobody saw, but it's very good. And he is very, very good in it. This movie, he's like kind of captured the young, tough, you know, young hoodlum vibe, but, you know, still kind of got a heart of gold. Like, I feel like between these two movies, he is making a very strong case to Denis Villeneuve, like, hey, I'm British. I'm in my 20s. I'm pretty buff. I could do things. I'm just saying he'd be a good Bond. And Antonio Banderas has a charming, twitchy weirdness always. And that transfers pretty nicely to a chef character here. Mostly, though, I was watching the film and just won over by its commitment to the importance of just basic decency. It's really compelling without being saccharine. Hard trick to pull off. Alyssa, what did you make of Tony?
So I am very primed to like this movie because not only do I generally like Anthony Bourdain's shtick, I thought he was a good writer, I enjoyed his show. I love Cape Cod and grew up going there, right? Mm-hmm. I grew up on, you know, going to the lobster pool in Orleans and picking out lobsters to be steamed for dinner. My high school Gay Straight Alliance would go to Provincetown every summer and we would get slices at Spiritus Pizza. I love going to the Brewster Fish House in Brewster, which is exactly the kind of restaurant that the flagship becomes. It, you know, it looks unprepossessing from the outside, but actually there are really incredible, talented people working in the kitchen and they produce sort of beautiful and impressive, but not necessarily pretentious food. I grew up on those kinds of beaches, you know, not quite as blue as the water out of, you know, chef's backyard view, but Cape Cod is my place, right? It's not a place where I spend as much time in recent years because we live a lot further away now, but it is really just sort of embedded in me in a very deep way. And so I think the vibes of this movie are immaculate. I think it was actually largely shot there. And it is also one of my favorite kinds of stories in which the twist is that people are nice and honest, right? It's the big question of the final third of the movie is whether Tony is going to fall back into Sal's sort of compelling dirtbag ways, or if he is going to make up for a significant wrong that he did. And the twist, again, is that he ends up capable of being a decent person when the movie leaves a lot of doubt for much of the run, whether he is capable of that in a sustained way, whether he is capable of being honest, right? He comes across as almost a pathological liar for a significant early part of the movie. Is he capable of hard work or is he just a complete screw-up drunk who is more seduced by Leo Woodall as Sal's very charming dissidence. And So I think it really sort of sticks the landing on him rewiring himself to be a different kind of person. And I think this movie has quite a few fine performances in it. You know, Sunny, you talked about Don Excessa being incredibly good at being smarmy, but he also, I think, does quite a nice job in sort of the quieter moments of this movie. There is a scene where, you know, he's been doing a lot of cocaine with Sal. They've been hanging out. They've been drinking. They've been going to parties. And then Sal buys what is, I think, supposed to be heroin, ties his arm off and shoots up. And you see the needle, but mostly what you see is Sessa's face watching him, right? And making a calculation about sort of whether the fun has gone too far, whether this is this who I am? Am I, you know, and he's turned down going in on the drugs in the first place, conveniently, because he doesn't have any cash because he is, in fact, completely broke. But there is this, moment of weighing what kind of person he is. And I just really enjoy watching Sessa's face in those kinds of moments, that whether he's, you know, slicing up a tuna. And he, you know, it is a movie about two men, about men watching each other to a certain extent, and one woman. But, you know, Chef spends a lot of time watching him, right, from the other side of the kitchen where, you know, he's at his dishwashing station. Tony is constantly trying to peek in the windows of Chef's house because he's not allowed inside. You know, Tony and Sal work at stations across from each other. It's a movie that is about honesty, but it's also a movie about attention, right? And actually paying attention to the people around you, learning, you know, putting the kind of attentive work in so you can shuck an oyster properly. There is this moment when Tony loses focus when Chef is teaching him how to shuck an oyster properly, doesn't absorb the lesson, and cuts himself quite badly, right? And
wait, you know, I'm sorry. Would you say that he stabs himself in the palm as if where a nail might go if you were being hung up on a cross? Is that what happens?
He self-stigmatizes. Yes, I suppose you could say that. It might be stretching the metaphor a little far, but yeah, I think Leo Woodall is good in this. I think Dominic Sessa is good in this. I think Antonio Banderas is great in it. And I also think Emilia Jones, who I quite liked in Coda, even though I do not think that was the best picture of the year in which it was released, is quite nice in this. And again, you know, part of their relationship blooms when she is taking pictures of him for the book that he is ostensibly working on. You know, he says to her, "I like how I feel when you look at me." And it is, yes, it's a movie about honesty. It's a movie about hard work. It's also a movie about just the value and virtue of attention and about seeing the world as it is, as opposed to sort of posing the world as you want it to be and then hoping it conforms to your desires.
Can I, Alyssa, I assume you've read Kitchen Confidential, I assume?
Yeah.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So can I get your thoughts on the way that we first, and so to be clear, this movie is largely fictionalized. This is not strictly speaking totally true. But I thought it was, I really thought it was interesting to see first his self-conception of what a great book would look like, right? He's, yes, he's riffing on like, it's, you know, it's a Buildings Roman. You know, as he kind of mispronounces it, about it's kind of like Kerouac by way of, you know,
Orwell, and it's 1984 and it's meets On the Road.
Just the worst, most pretentious, most like literary kid, you know, claptrap that you could imagine. But it's very obviously based on nothing he has actually experienced. It's just he has read books and he is like, I would like to make books that are like these books. And what's really striking about this film is that it's we obviously he never writes that book. And instead he writes Kitchen Confidential, which is an enormous success and like arguably changes the world of memoir writing, certainly, or memoir publication really generally, but also like the world of kitchens and chefs and like There's just this book has reverberations throughout the culture in a way
it's
that
nearly
his terrible
a straight line from the kitchen the cooking influencers of TikTok today back to Anthony Bourdain.
I think it's
media personality as we know it.
I think it is interesting that what we see in this film is almost a complete repudiation of the idea of art that he comes in with. That it's like art comes from experience, from what you do, from what you live, not from the other art that you consume, which I think is an important point for people to absorb.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Kitchen Confidential, it's a very funny, raw, sometimes sort of disturbing book, but it's about secret worlds. It's about sort of physicality and dirt and muck and economics. I mean, it's about life, right? But it's very much about sort of the real experience behind the facade that you're participating in when you are sitting in the dining room at Lizelle. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Peter, you really liked Banderas in this, right?
Yeah. Like, I think this is a pretty good movie with two standout elements. The first is the cinematography by Michael Baumann, who has worked with P.T. Anderson. Actually hasn't made that many movies. I think he's just made a trio of features with P.T. Anderson, and this is his fourth film, his first without Anderson. And then Antonio Banderas, who is absolutely the soul of this movie, gives by far the best performance. Every single scene with him is significantly better than any scene that doesn't have Antonio Banderas. And it's not that the other scenes are bad. It's that when Antonio Banderas comes on screen, he owns it in this way that it's quiet and it's soft, and it's also just sort of takes up space with him not doing things, right? There are moments when he is just, you get a little scowl, or maybe you get almost nothing at all, but like there's something in the tension in his shoulders that you can't look away from. And you just see how little he is doing and how much the gravity of the movie moves towards him every single time he is on screen. He's the character who gives the movie its like real warmth, right? And its heart, I guess. But even though he's kind of irascible, difficult, angry sometimes even, a little bit of a jerk. And also we see him in his kitchen excusing, drug use and all sorts of other stuff that he knows it's going on and is allowing it to happen there, because at a certain point he kind of understands. He's got a bunch of young men he has to care for. And while on the one hand, he needs to keep them in line, he also, they're young men and they're going to be a mess. They're going to be angry. They're going to be difficult. And it's just a truly wonderful performance. And I think this movie, between Banderas and between what you're talking about with, sort of young Tony Bourdain as this writer who hasn't done anything, who wants to be a kind of literary personage, but it doesn't have any real material until he finds his way into the kitchen and then has to spend 20 years collecting it. This is, I don't know how intentional it is, because it doesn't seem to like sort of poke directly at the discourse. But this piece, this movie really seems like a great entry into like how to think about, I don't know, how men are different, how male writers are different. All right. Like we've had all of this kind of discussion. I looked it up. It's like at least three or four pieces just in the New York Times alone. I'm not looking at New York Magazine or Substack, right? Just about like the decline of the literary man, how men don't read anymore, right? How the publishing ranks are, like the editors, the writers, the readers, that's mostly, it's mostly women, it's the rise of romanticism, all of this. And what you see here is among other things, a story about a boy, or an almost man, who wants to be a writer. And he is, among other things, he's not tidy. He's not easy to be. He's like actually like quite difficult, a jerk. He's a drunk. He is, I mean, it in at least one of these crucial scenes, as you talked about, Sonny, with the waitress after he is spurned by the woman he went to Providence for, he is like, you know, borderline legally actionable in physically touching, laying hands on a woman while he's drunk who doesn't want his attentions, right? It does not sugarcoat this stuff. And yet the movie has a kind of sympathy for him and shows that, look, men like that can grow up. But what they need is a couple of things. They need some discipline. They need some time. They need a good mentor who both understands what it's like to be a young man and then also expects you to like actually show up and just wash the damn dishes and like wash them until they're actually clean. No, not just like, right, you just wash them until they're actually clean, but also understands, okay, you know what? You're probably going to experiment with Coke and drink too much too. And it's not going to be this sort of moralizing thing. It's going to be like, do you want to have a good life? Here's how you can do it. And then the other thing is this movie really emphasizes not just experience, which is what you talked about, though it does, but it really emphasizes how for all of the guys in this movie, what they need is something physical. They need to put their hands on the dishes and the big fish and the knife and the right. And they need to like see something. They need to manipulate the physical world and become good at that. And that, like, just like when Bourdain in this movie starts to see that he can be good at manipulating the physical world, even in sort of in a very early way, you get this thing that you don't see often in modern media, really, in movies generally, where you see a young man become excited by the fact that he can make something physical and real in the world. And he's changing the physical world around him, and not through violence either. Right. So you sometimes see that in movies. Oh, he's learned to be an awesome killer. Right. But like, no, it's just, he has learned to make something real and physical. I mean, I think the last time I saw anything anywhere close to this was in The Fabelmans, where our young, you know, Spielberg stand in is there, you know, that incredible montage of him working with his editing machine. And you just see that like so much of his education, his coming of age as a man is manipulating the physical frames, like figuring out how to do this very physical art form. And this movie and The Fabelmans share a little bit of DNA in that respect. But this movie like just gets it, that sort of that moment in life that's really pretty common for young men. You want to be great in the world, but you haven't done anything and you don't know how to do anything. And you have to start by just washing the dishes and then eventually learning to open one oyster the right way. And it opens a whole world to you when you do.
You know what else?
They taste like the future. Oysters taste like the future.
So pretentious. So it, like, she just looks at him like he is... Anyway, the other thing young men need, in addition to working with their hands and a role model who will... They need providence. The protective attention of God. Like, again, this is like, it's such a, if you had told me that Angel Studios co-financed this film, I would not be shocked. And it's just very interesting to me that this thread is running through it, given Bourdain's own, you know, antipathy.
I think we need to have a triple feature of 2026 surprisingly religious movies with this, The Sheep Detectives and Project Hail Mary.
I could see it. Maybe we can invite like a religious friend of the pod on to a religious friend of the pod and movie lover on to talk about it with us.
Hey, do we know any extremely Catholic film critics who used to work for National Review and maybe don't have a place to talk about movies anymore?
The year in film and God. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Tony? Peter.
It's a pretty good movie. Thumbs up. I think maybe I liked it a little less than you and Alyssa. Seems a little slight at times to me, actually, but it gets a lot right, and Banderas is just a marvel.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. I look forward to maybe embarrassing my son by showing this to him someday.
Thumbs up. I don't know why he would. I don't think he'd be embarrassed. I don't know. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.